This story of the Frog King from the Grimm's fairy tales is an example of one of the ways in which the adventure can begin. A blunder, apparently the merest chance, reveals an unsuspected world, and the individual is drawn into a relationship with forces that are not rightly understood. As Freud has shown, blunders are not the merest chance. They are the result of suppressed desires and conflicts. They are ripples on the surface of life produced by unsuspected springs. And these may be very deep as the soul itself. The blunder may amount to the opening of a destiny. Thus it happens in this fairy tale that the disappearance of the ball is the first sign of something coming for the princess. The frog is the second, and the unconsidered promise is the third. As a preliminary manifestation of the powers that are breaking into play, the frog, coming up as it were by miracle, can be termed the herald. The crisis of his appearance is the call to adventure. The herald's summons may be to live, as in the present instance, or at a later moment of the biography, to die. It may sound the call to some high historical undertaking, or it may mark the dawn of religious illumination. As apprehended by the mystic, it marks what has been termed the awakening of the self. In the case of the princess of the fairy tale, it signified no more than the coming of adolescence. But whether great or small, and no matter what the stage or grade of life, the call rings up the curtain, always, on a mystery of transfiguration, a rite or moment of spiritual passage, which, when complete, amounts to a dying and a birth. The familiar life horizon has been outgrown, the old concepts, ideals, and emotional patterns no longer fit, the time for the passing of a threshold is at hand. This first stage of the mythological journey, which we have designated the call to adventure, signifies that destiny has summoned the hero and transferred his spiritual center of gravity from within the pale of his society to a zone unknown. This fateful region is both treasure and danger and may be variously represented as a distant land, a forest, a kingdom underground, beneath the waves or above the sky, a secret island, lofty mountain, or profound dream state. But it is always a place of strangely fluid and polymorphous beings, unimaginable torments, superhuman deeds, and impossible delight. The hero can venture forth of his own volition to accomplish the adventure, as did Theseus when he arrived in his father's city, Athens, and heard the horrible story of the Minotaur. Or he may be carried or sent abroad by some benign or malignant agent, as was Odysseus, driven about the Mediterranean by the winds of the angered god Poseidon. The adventure may begin as a mere blunder, or still again, one may only be casually strolling when some passing phenomenon catches the wandering eye and lures one away from the frequented paths of man. Examples might be multiplied ad infinitum from every corner of the world. Refusal of the call. Often in actual life, and not infrequently in the myths and popular tales, we encounter the dull case of the call unanswered, for it is always possible to turn the ear to other interests. Refusal of the summons converts the adventure into its negative. Walled in boredom, hard work, or culture, the subject loses the power of significant affirmative action and becomes a victim to be saved. His flowering world becomes a wasteland of dry stones, and his life feels meaningless, even though, like King Minos, he may, through titanic effort, succeed in building an empire of renown. Whatever house he builds, it will be a house of death, a labyrinth of cyclopean walls to hide from him his minotaur. All he can do is create new problems for himself and await the gradual approach of his disintegration. The myths and folktales of the whole world make clear that the refusal is essentially a refusal to give up what one takes to be one's own interest. The future is regarded not in terms of an unremitting series of deaths and births, but as though one's present system of ideals, virtues, goals, and advantages were to be fixed and made secure. King Minos retained the divine bull when the sacrifice would have signified submission to the will of the god of his society, for he preferred what he conceived to be his economic advantage. Thus he failed to advance into the life role that he had assumed, and we have seen with what calamitous effect. The divinity itself became his terror. For if one is oneself, one's own God, then God himself becomes a monster. These are the opening lines of Francis Thompson's The Hound of Heaven. I fled him down the nights and down the days. I fled him down the arches of the years. I fled him down the labyrinthine ways of my own mind, and in the mist of tears I hid from him and under running laughter. One is harassed both day and night by the divine being that is the image of the living self within the locked labyrinth of one's own distorted psyche. The ways to the gates have all been lost. There is no exit. One can only cling, like Satan, furiously to oneself and be in hell, or else break and be annihilated at last in God. Again, the hound of heaven. Our fondest, blindest, weakest, I am he whom thou seekest. Thou dravest love from thee who dravest me. The same harrowing, mysterious voice was to be heard in the call of the Greek god Apollo to the fleeing maiden Daphne, daughter of the river Peneus, as he pursued her over the plain. O nymph, O Peneus' daughter, stay, the deity called to her, like the frog to the princess in the fairy tale. I who pursue thee am no enemy. Thou knowest not whom thou fleest, and for that reason dost thou flee. Run with less speed, I pray, and hold thy flight. I too will follow with less speed. Nay, stop and ask who thy lover is. He would have said more, the story goes, from Ovid's Metamorphosis, but the maiden pursued her frightened way and left him with words unfinished, even in her desertion seeming fair. The winds bared her limbs, the opposing breezes set her garments aflutter as she ran, and a light air flung her locks streaming behind her. Her beauty was enhanced by flight, but the chase drew to an end, for the youthful god would not longer waste his time in coaxing words, and urged on by love, he pursued at utmost speed. Just as when a Gallic hound has seen a hare in the open plain and seeks his prey on flying feet, but the hare, safety. He, just about to fasten on her, now, even now, thinks he has her and grazes her very heels with his outstretched muzzle, but she knows not whether or not she be already caught and barely escapes from those sharp fangs and leaves behind the jaws just closing on her. So ran the god and the maid. He sped by hope and she by fear. But he ran the more swiftly, borne on the wings of love, gave her no time to rest, hung over her fleeing shoulders, and breathed on the hair that streamed over her neck. Now was all her strength gone, and pale with fear, and utterly overcome by the toil of her swift flight, seeing the waters of her father's river near, she cried, O father, help! If your waters hold divinity, change and destroy this beauty by which I pleased o'er well. Scarce had she thus prayed, when a down-dragging numbness seized her limbs, and her soft sides were begirt with thin bark. Her hair was changed to leaves, her arms to branches. Her feet, but now so swift, grew fast in sluggish roots, and her head was now but a tree's top. Her gleaming beauty alone remained. This is indeed a dull and unrewarding finish. Apollo, the sun, the lord of time and ripeness, no longer pressed his frightening suit, but instead simply named the laurel his favorite tree, and ironically recommended its leaves to the fashioners of victory wreaths. The girl had retreated to the image of her parent and there found protection. The literature of psychoanalysis abounds in examples of such desperate fixations. What they represent is an impotence to put off the infantile ego with its sphere of emotional relationships and ideals. One is bound in by the walls of childhood. The father and mother stand as threshold guardians, and the timorous soul, fearful of some punishment, fails to make the passage through the door and come to birth in the world without. Not all who hesitate are lost. The psyche has many secrets in reserve, and these are not disclosed unless required. So it is that sometimes the predicament following an obstinate refusal of the call proves to be the occasion of a providential revelation of some unsuspected principle of release. Willed introversion, in fact, is one of the classic implements of creative genius and can be employed as a deliberate device. The result, of course, may be a disintegration of consciousness more or less complete, neurosis, psychosis, the plight of the spellbound Daphne. But on the other hand, if the personality is able to absorb and integrate the new forces, there will be experienced an almost superhuman degree of self-consciousness and masterful control. This is a basic principle of the Indian disciplines of yoga. It cannot be described, quite as an answer to any specific call. Rather, it is a deliberate, terrific refusal to respond to anything but the deepest, highest, richest answer to the as yet unknown demand of some waiting void within. A kind of total strike or rejection of the offered terms of life, as a result of which some power of transformation carries the problem to a plane of new magnitudes, where it is suddenly and finally resolved.
Now, there are two kinds of starting out to adventure. One is the one that is yours. It has come to you in the way of an inner voice or a readiness for a certain kind of adventure. The other is following a crowd. That's not being your adventure. If it's going to be your adventure, there will appear as you approach what I call the threshold of adventure, the threshold of real danger, getting out of bounds, there will appear a little guiding voice. I'm calling this magical aid. A little dwarf, a little animal, a little worm will say, "Where are you going?" And you will say, "Such and such and such and such." And the voice will say, "Well, this is very dangerous. You can't do that." And you will say, "Yes, but I know I'm going to do it." And they'll say, "Well, here's a little thought to hold in your mind. Or here's a little trinket to have hanging from your chest. Or here's something else that's going to guide you and protect you and carry you through this journey. You're given magical aid. You're a little guide. And when you're in trouble, hang on to that, kid, and forget everything else." It's actually a fact. Your adventure is your adventure. And if it is yours, the world will open. Where other people would run into obstacles and blocks, it will open for you. You get on the road and are thumbing your way. The car that stops has the people in it that are just the ones that can carry you that distance and give you advice and perhaps a $5 bill to carry you on the rest of the way. All that kind of thing, magical aid.
Among the American Indians of the Southwest, the favorite personage in this benign role is Spider Woman, a grandmotherly little person who lives underground. The twin war gods of the Navajo, on the way to the house of their father, the Sun, had hardly departed from their home following a holy trail when they came upon this wonderful little figure, here described in the 1897 book Navajo Legends by Washington Matthews. The boys traveled rapidly in the holy trail and soon after sunrise, near Tsilnaotl, saw smoke arising from the ground. They went to the place where the smoke rose, and they found it came from the smoke hole of a subterranean chamber. A ladder, black from smoke, projected through the hole. Looking down into the chamber, they saw an old woman, the Spider Woman, who glanced up at them and said, "Welcome, children. Enter. Who are you? And whence do you come walking together?" They made no answer, but descended the ladder. When they reached the floor, she spoke again to them, asking, "Whither do you two go walking together?" "Nowhere in particular," they answered. "We came here because we had nowhere else to go." She asked this question four times, and each time she received a similar answer. Then she said, "Perhaps you would seek your father." "Yes," they answered, "if we only knew the way to his dwelling." "Ah," said the woman, "it is a long and dangerous way to the house of your father, the Sun. There are many monsters dwelling between here and there, and perhaps, when you get there, your father may not be glad to see you and may punish you for coming. You must pass four places of danger: the rocks that crush the traveler, the reeds that cut him to pieces, the cane cactuses that tear him to pieces, and the boiling sands that overwhelm him. But I shall give you something to subdue your enemies and preserve your lives." She gave them a charm called Feather of the Alien Gods, which consisted of a hoop with two feathers plucked from a living eagle attached, and another life feather to preserve their existence. She taught them also this magic formula, which, if repeated to their enemies, would subdue their anger: "Put your feet down with pollen. Put your hands down with pollen. Put your head down with pollen. Then your feet are pollen. Your hands are pollen. Your body is pollen. Your mind is pollen. Your voice is pollen. The trail is beautiful. Be still." The helpful crone and fairy godmother is a familiar feature of European fairy lore. In Christian saints' legends, the role is commonly played by the Virgin. The Virgin, by her intercession, can win the mercy of the Father. Spider Woman with her web, can control the movements of the sun. The hero who has come under the protection of the Cosmic Mother cannot be harmed. The thread of Ariadne brought Theseus safely through the adventure of the labyrinth. This is the guiding power that runs through the work of Dante in the female figures of Beatrice and the Virgin, and appears in Goethe's Faust, successively as Gretchen, Helen of Troy, and the Virgin. "Thou art the living font of hope," prays Dante at the end of his safe passage through the perils of the three worlds. "Lady, thou art so great and so availest that whoso would have grace and has not recourse to thee would have his desire fly without wings. Thy benign grace not only sustains him who asks, but oftentimes freely foreruns the asking. In thee mercy, in thee pity, in thee magnificence, in thee whatever of goodness is in any creature are united." What such a figure represents is the benign, protecting power of destiny. The fantasy is a reassurance, a promise that the peace of paradise, which was known first within the mother womb, is not to be lost, that it supports the present and stands in the future as well as in the past. One has only to know and trust, and the ageless guardians will appear. Having responded to his own call and continuing to follow courageously as the consequences unfold, the hero finds all the forces of the unconscious at his side. Mother Nature herself supports the mighty task, and insofar as the hero's act coincides with that for which his society itself is ready, he seems to ride on the great rhythm of the historical process. "I feel myself," said Napoleon at the opening of his Russian campaign, "driven toward an end that I do not know. As soon as I shall have reached it, as soon as I shall have become unnecessary, an atom will suffice to shatter me. Till then, not all the forces of mankind can do anything against me." Not infrequently, the supernatural helper is masculine in form. In fairy lore, it may be some little fellow of the wood, some wizard, hermit, shepherd, or smith, who appears to supply the amulets and advice that the hero will require. The higher mythologies develop the role in the great figure of the guide, the teacher, the ferryman, the conductor of souls to the afterworld. In classical myth, this is Hermes Mercury. In Egyptian, usually Thoth, the ibis god, the baboon god. In Christian, the Holy Ghost. Goethe presents the masculine guide in Faust as Mephistopheles, and not infrequently, the dangerous aspect of the mercurial figure is stressed. For he is the lurer of the innocent soul into realms of trial. In Dante's vision, the part is played by Virgil, who yields to Beatrice at the threshold of paradise. Protective and dangerous, motherly and fatherly at the same time, this supernatural principle of guardianship and direction unites in itself all the ambiguities of the unconscious. The hero to whom such a helper appears is typically one who has responded to the call. The call, in fact, was the first announcement of the approach of this initiatory priest. But even to those who apparently have hardened their hearts, the supernatural guardian may appear. The crossing of the first threshold.
Then you come to the edge of the world. That place psychologically that no one has ever explored for you, that you have to do on your very own. And this I call the threshold of adventure. Before that, you're in more or less mapped out territory. There are a number of typical crises representing this point. What emerges to confront you is the absolute danger of darkness. This will be represented in the form of a typical creature, a dragon, a whale. And in the Arthurian romance is often a knight in black armor with visor down, so it's just this impersonal monster. And when he is defeated and the visor's taken off, he's the hero's brother.
With the personifications of his destiny to guide and aid him, the hero goes forward in his adventure until he comes to the threshold guardian at the entrance to the zone of magnified power. Such custodians bound the world in the four directions, also up and down, standing for the limits of the hero's present sphere, or life horizon. Beyond them is darkness, the unknown, and danger. Just as beyond the parental watch is danger to the infant, and beyond the protection of his society, danger to the member of the tribe. The usual person is more than content. He is even proud to remain within the indicated bounds. Thus, the sailors of the bold vessels of Columbus, breaking the horizon of the medieval mind, sailing, as they thought, into the boundless ocean of immortal being that surrounds the cosmos, like an endless mythological serpent biting its tail, had to be cozened and urged on like children because of their fear of the fabled leviathans, mermaids, dragon kings, and other monsters of the deep. The folk mythologies populate with deceitful and dangerous presences every desert place outside the normal traffic of the village. For example, the Hottentots describe an ogre that has been occasionally encountered among the scrubs and dunes. Its eyes are set on its instep, so that to discover what is going on, it has to get down on hands and knees and hold up one foot. The eye then looks behind. Otherwise, it is gazing continually at the sky. This monster is a hunter of men, whom it tears to shreds with cruel teeth as long as fingers. The creature is said to hunt in packs. Another Hottentot apparition, the Hai-Uri, progresses by leaping over clumps of scrub instead of going around them. A dangerous, one-legged, one-armed, one-sided figure, the half-man, invisible if viewed from the offside, is encountered in many parts of the earth. In Central Africa, it is declared that such a half-man says to the person who has encountered him, "Since you have met with me, let us fight together." If thrown, he will plead, "Do not kill me. I will show you lots of medicines." And then the lucky person becomes a proficient doctor. But if the half-man, called Chiruwi, a mysterious thing, wins, his victim dies. "I dreamed," stated a middle-aged married gentleman in Wilhelm Steckel's book, Fortschritte und Technik der Traumdeutung, "that I wanted to get into a wonderful garden. But before it, there was a watchman who would not permit me to enter. I saw that my friend, Fräulein Elsa, was within. She wanted to reach me her hand over the gate. But the watchman prevented that, took me by the arm, and conducted me home. 'Do be sensible, after all,' he said. 'You know you mustn't do that.'" This is a dream that brings out the sense of the first or protective aspect of the threshold guardian. One had better not challenge the watcher of the established bounds. And yet, it is only by advancing beyond those bounds, provoking the destructive other aspect of the same power, that the individual passes, either alive or in death, into a new zone of experience. In the language of the pygmies of the Andaman Islands, the word Okujumu, one who speaks from dreams, designates those highly respected and feared individuals who are distinguished from their fellows by the possession of supernatural talents, which can be acquired only by meeting with the spirits, directly in the jungle, through extraordinary dream, or by death and return. The adventure is always and everywhere a passage beyond the veil of the known into the unknown. The powers that watch at the boundary are dangerous. To deal with them is risky. Yet for anyone with competence and courage, the danger fades. Adapted with slight abridgment from the translation of Eugene Watson Burlingame's Buddhist Parables comes a story of a young prince who had just completed his military studies under a world-renowned teacher. Having received as a symbol of his distinction the title Prince Five Weapons, he accepted the five weapons that his teacher gave him, bowed, and, armed with the new weapons, struck out onto the road leading to the city of his father, the king. On the way, he came to a certain forest. People at the mouth of the forest warned him, "Sir Prince, do not enter this forest," they said. "An ogre lives here named Sticky Hair. He kills every man he sees." But the prince was confident and fearless as a maned lion. He entered the forest just the same. When he reached the heart of it, the ogre showed himself. The ogre had increased his stature to the height of a palm tree. He had created for himself a head as big as a summer house, with bell-shaped pinnacle, eyes as big as alms bowls, two tusks as big as giant bulbs or buds. He had the beak of a hawk. His belly was covered with blotches. His hands and feet were dark green. "Where are you going?" he demanded. "Halt! You are my prey." Prince Five Weapons answered without fear, but with great confidence in the arts and crafts that he had learned. "Ogre," said he, "I know what I was about when I entered this forest. You would do well to be careful about attacking me, for with an arrow steeped in poison, I will pierce your flesh and fell you on the spot." Having thus threatened the ogre, the young prince fitted to his bow an arrow steeped in deadly poison and let fly. It stuck right in the ogre's hair. Then he let fly one after another 50 arrows. All stuck right to the ogre's hair. The ogre shook off every one of those arrows, letting them fall right at his feet, and approached the young prince. Prince Five Weapons threatened the ogre a second time, and drawing his sword, delivered a masterly blow. The sword, 33 inches long, stuck right to the ogre's hair. Then the prince smote him with a spear. That also stuck right to his hair. Perceiving that the spear had stuck, he smote him with a club. That also stuck right to his hair. When he saw that the club had stuck, he said, "Master Ogre, you have never heard of me before. I am Prince Five Weapons. When I entered this forest infested by you, I took no account of bows and such like weapons. When I entered this forest, I took account only of myself. Now I am going to beat you and pound you into powder and dust." Having thus made known his determination, with a yell he struck the ogre with his right hand. His hand stuck right to the ogre's hair. He struck him with his left hand. That also stuck. He struck him with his right foot. That also stuck. He struck him with his left foot. That also stuck. Thought he, "I will beat you with my head and pound you into powder and dust." He struck him with his head. That also stuck right to the ogre's hair. Prince Five Weapons snared five times, stuck fast in five places, dangled from the ogre's body. But for all that, he was unafraid, undaunted. As for the ogre, he thought, "This is some lion of a man, some man of noble birth, no mere man. For although he has been caught by an ogre like me, he appears neither to tremble nor to quake. In all the time I have harried this road, I have never, never seen a single man to match him. Why, pray, is he not afraid?" Not daring to eat him, he asked, "Youth, why are you not afraid? Why are you not terrified with the fear of death?" "Ogre, why should I be afraid? For in one life, one death is absolutely certain. What's more, I have in my belly a thunderbolt for weapon. If you eat me, you will not be able to digest that weapon. It will tear your insides to tatters and fragments and will kill you. In that case, we'll both perish. That's why I'm not afraid." Prince Five Weapons, the listener must know, was referring to the weapon of knowledge that was within him. Indeed, this young hero was none other than the future Buddha in an earlier incarnation. "What this youth says is true," thought the ogre, terrified with the fear of death. "From the body of this lion of a man, my stomach would not be able to digest a fragment of flesh, even so small as a kidney bean. I'll let him go." And he let Prince Five Weapons go. The future Buddha preached the doctrine to him, subdued him, made him self-denying, and then transformed him into a spirit entitled to receive offerings in the forest. Having admonished the ogre to be heedful, the youth departed from the forest, and at the mouth of the forest told his story to human beings, then went his way. As a symbol of the world to which the five senses glue us, and which cannot be pressed aside by the actions of the physical organs, sticky hair was subdued only when the future Buddha, no longer protected by the five weapons of his momentary name and physical character, resorted to the unnamed, invisible sixth. The divine thunderbolt of the knowledge of the transcendent principle which is beyond the phenomenal realm of names and forms. Therewith, the situation changed. He was no longer caught, but released, for that which he now remembered himself to be is ever free. The force of the monster of phenomenality was dispelled, and he was rendered self-denying. Self-denying, he became divine, a spirit entitled to receive offerings, as is the world itself when known, not as final, but as a mere name and form of that which transcends, yet is immanent within all names and forms. The belly of the whale.
In the whale's belly, the hero goes into the abyss alive. In the crucifixion, he goes in dead. The cross, I've told you, is the symbol of the world. He goes through the cross, goes through the midpoint, leaves the four dimensions behind him, goes through the midpoint, the sun door. This is the image of the what the Germans call the Klappfelsen, the Symplegades, the clashing rocks, the pair of opposites, good and evil, true and false, this and that. You're going through it. You go through just at the moment when the crash comes.
The idea that the passage of the magical threshold is a transit into a sphere of rebirth is symbolized in the worldwide womb image of the belly of the whale. The hero, instead of conquering or conciliating the power of the threshold, is swallowed into the unknown and would appear to have died. From Longfellow's book, The Song of Hiawatha. Mishenama, king of fishes, in his wrath he darted upward, flashing, leaped into the sunshine, opened his great jaws and swallowed both canoe and Hiawatha. The Eskimo of the Bering Strait tell of the trickster hero Raven, how one day, as he sat drying his clothes on a beach, he observed a whale cow swimming gravely close to shore. He called, "Next time you come up for air, dear, open your mouth and shut your eyes." Then he slipped quickly into his raven clothes, pulled on his raven mask, gathered his fire sticks under his arm, and flew out over the water. The whale came up. She did as she had been told. Raven darted through the open jaws and straight into her gullet. The shocked whale cow snapped and sounded. Raven stood inside and looked around. The Zulus have a story of two children and their mother swallowed by an elephant. When the woman reached the animal's stomach, she saw large forests and great rivers and many high lands. On one side there were many rocks, and there were many people who had built their village there, and many dogs, and many cattle. All was there inside the elephant. The Irish hero, Finn MacCool, was swallowed by a monster of indefinite form, of the type known to the Celtic world as a paste. The little German girl, Red Riding Hood, was swallowed by a wolf. The Polynesian favorite, Maui, was swallowed by his great-great-grandmother, Hine Nui Te Po. And the whole Greek pantheon, with the exception of Zeus, was swallowed by its father, Kronos. The Greek hero Heracles, pausing at Troy on his way homeward with the belt of the Queen of the Amazons, found that the city was being harassed by a monster sent against it by the sea god Poseidon. The beast would come ashore and devour people as they moved about on the plain. Beautiful Hesione, the daughter of the king, had just been bound by her father to the sea rocks as a propitiatory sacrifice, and the great visiting hero agreed to rescue her for a price. The monster, in due time, broke to the surface of the water and opened its enormous maw. Heracles took a dive into the throat, cut his way out through the belly, and left the monster dead. This popular motif gives emphasis to the lesson that the passage of the threshold is a form of self-annihilation. Instead of passing outward, beyond the confines of the visible world, the hero goes inward to be born again. The disappearance corresponds to the passing of a worshipper into a temple, where he is to be quickened by the recollection of who and what he is, namely, dust and ashes, unless immortal. The temple interior, the belly of the whale, and the heavenly land beyond, above and below the confines of the world, are one and the same. That is why the approaches and entrances of temples are flanked and defended by colossal gargoyles, dragons, lions, devil slayers with drawn swords, resentful dwarfs, winged bulls. These are the threshold guardians to ward away all incapable of encountering the higher silences within. They are preliminary embodiments of the dangerous aspect of the presence, corresponding to the mythological ogres that bound the conventional world, or to the two rows of teeth of the whale. They illustrate the fact that the devotee at the moment of entry into a temple undergoes a metamorphosis. His secular character remains without. He sheds it, as a snake sheds its skin. Once inside, he may be said to have died to time and returned to the world womb, the world navel, the earthly paradise. The mere fact that anyone can physically walk past the temple guardians does not invalidate their significance, for if the intruder is incapable of encompassing the sanctuary, then he has effectually remained without. Anyone unable to understand a god sees it as a devil and is thus defended from the approach. Allegorically, then, the passage into a temple and the hero dive through the jaws of the whale are identical ventures, both denoting in picture language the life-centering, life-renewing act. Ananda Kumaraswamy writes, "No creature can attain a higher grade of nature without ceasing to exist." Indeed, the physical body of the hero may be actually slain, dismembered, and scattered over the land or sea, as in the Egyptian myth of the savior Osiris. He was thrown into a sarcophagus and committed to the Nile by his brother Set, and when he returned from the dead, his brother slew him again, tore the body into 14 pieces, and scattered those over the land. The twin heroes of the Navajo had to pass not only the clashing rocks, but also the reeds that cut the traveler to pieces, the cane cactuses that tear him to pieces, and the boiling sands that overwhelm him. The hero whose attachment to ego is already annihilated passes back and forth across the horizons of the world, in and out of the dragon, as readily as a king through all the rooms of his house. And therein lies his power to save, for his passing and returning demonstrate that through all the contraries of phenomenality, the uncreate, imperishable remains, and there is nothing to fear. Initiation, beginning with the road of trials. Once having traversed the threshold, the hero moves in a dream landscape of curiously fluid, ambiguous forms, where he must survive a succession of trials. This is a favorite phase of the myth adventure. It has produced a world literature of miraculous tests and ordeals. The hero is covertly aided by the advice, amulets, and secret agents of the supernatural helper whom he met before his entrance into this region. Or it may be that here he discovers for the first time that there is a benign power everywhere supporting him in his superhuman passage. One of the best known and most charming examples of the difficult tasks motif is that of Psyche's quest for her lost lover, Cupid. Here, all the principal roles are reversed. Instead of the lover trying to win his bride, it is the bride trying to win her lover. And instead of a cruel father withholding his daughter from the lover, it is the jealous mother, Venus, hiding her son, Cupid, from his bride. When Psyche pleaded with Venus, the goddess grasped her violently by the hair and dashed her head upon the ground, then took a great quantity of wheat, barley, millet, poppy seeds, peas, lentils, and beans, mingled all these together in a heap, and commanded the girl to sort them before night. Psyche was aided by an army of ants. Venus told her next to gather the golden wool of certain dangerous sheep, sharp of horn and poisonous of bite, that inhabited an inaccessible valley in a dangerous wood. But a green reed instructed her how to gather from the reeds round about the golden locks shed by the sheep in their passage. The goddess now required a bottle of water from a freezing spring high on a towering rock beset by sleepless dragons. An eagle approached and accomplished the marvelous task. Psyche was ordered finally to bring from the abyss of the underworld a box full of supernatural beauty. But a high tower told her how to go down to the world below, gave her coins for Charon and sops for Cerberus, and sped her on her way. If anyone, in whatever society, undertakes for himself the perilous journey into the darkness by descending, either intentionally or unintentionally, into the crooked lanes of his own spiritual labyrinth, he soon finds himself in a landscape of symbolical figures, any one of which may swallow him. In the vocabulary of the mystics, this is the second stage of the way, the purification of the self, when the senses are cleaned and humbled, and the energies and interests concentrated upon transcendental things. This is the process of dissolving, transcending, or transmuting the infantile images of our personal past. In our dreams, the ageless perils, gargoyles, trials, secret helpers, and instructive figures are nightly still encountered, and in their forms we may see reflected not only the whole picture of our present case, but also the clue to what we must do to be saved. There can be no question. The psychological dangers through which earlier generations were guided by the symbols and spiritual exercises of their mythological and religious inheritance, we today must face alone, or, at best, with only tentative, impromptu, and not often very effective guidance. This is our problem as modern, enlightened individuals, for whom all gods and devils have been rationalized out of existence. Nevertheless, in the multitude of myths and legends that have been preserved to us or collected from the ends of the earth, we may yet see delineated something of our still human course. To hear and profit, however, one may have to submit somehow to purgation and surrender, and that is part of our problem, just how to do it. As it says in the Quran, "Or do ye think that ye shall enter the garden of bliss without trials as came to those who passed away before you?" The original departure into the land of trials represented only the beginning of the long and really perilous path of initiatory conquests and moments of illumination. Dragons have now to be slain, and surprising barriers passed, again and again and again. Meanwhile, there will be a multitude of preliminary victories, unretainable ecstasies, and momentary glimpses of that wonderful land. The meeting with the goddess.
And now we come to the critical crisis. Now this is rendered in four different ways, each way representing a sort of style of thought, a mood or mode, and style of mythology.
Put them down as A, B, C, D.
A is the Heros Gamos, the sacred marriage. That is to say, the union of pairs of opposites in male-female term. The hero marries the goddess. The nymph is married to the god. This is the virgin birth motif. The symbology of pairs of opposites united, of temporal and eternal principles identified, is rendered in terms of the sexual polarity. This is the way of most of the fairy tales, many of the classical myths, infinite number of Oriental myths, and so forth.
The ultimate adventure, when all the barriers and ogres have been overcome, is commonly represented as a mystical marriage of the triumphant hero soul with the queen goddess of the world. This is the crisis at the nadir, the zenith, or at the utmost edge of the earth, at the central point of the cosmos, in the tabernacle of the temple, or within the darkness of the deepest chamber of the heart. In the west of Ireland, they still tell the tale of the Prince of the Lonesome Isle and the Lady of Tubertintai. Hoping to heal the Queen of Erin, the heroic youth had undertaken to go for 3 bottles of the water of Tubertintai, the flaming fairy well. Following the advice of a supernatural aunt whom he encountered on the way, and riding a wonderful, dirty, lean, little shaggy horse that she gave to him, he crossed a river of fire and escaped the touch of a grove of poison trees. The horse, with the speed of the wind, shot past the end of the castle of Tubertintai. The prince sprang from its back through an open window and came down inside, safe and sound. In the words of Jeremiah Curtin from his book Myths and Folklore of Ireland, "The whole place, enormous in extent, was filled with sleeping giants and monsters of sea and land, great whales, long slippery eels, bears and beasts of every form and kind. The prince passed through them and over them till he came to the great stairway. At the head of the stairway he went into a chamber where he found the most beautiful woman he had ever seen, stretched out on a couch, asleep. 'I'll have nothing to say to you,' thought he, and went on to the next. And so he looked into 12 chambers. In each was a woman more beautiful than the one before. But when he reached the 13th chamber and opened the door, the flash of gold took the sight from his eyes. He stood a while till the sight came back and then entered. In the great, bright chamber was a golden couch resting on wheels of gold. The wheels turned continually. The couch went round and round, never stopping, night or day. On the couch lay the queen of Tubertintai, and if her 12 maidens were beautiful, they would not be beautiful if seen near her. At the foot of the couch was Tubertintai itself, the well of fire. There was a golden cover upon the well, and it went around continually with the couch of the queen. 'Upon my word,' said the prince, 'I'll rest here a while.' And he went up on the couch and never left it for 6 days and nights. The lady of the house of sleep is a familiar figure in fairy tale and myth. She is the paragon of all paragons of beauty, the reply to all desire, the bliss-bestowing goal of every hero's earthly and unearthly quest. She is mother, sister, mistress, bride. Whatever in the world has lured, whatever has seemed to promise joy, she is the incarnation of the promise of perfection, the soul's assurance that at the conclusion of its exile in a world of organized inadequacies, the bliss that was once known will be known again. The comforting, the nourishing, the good mother, young and beautiful, who was known to us and even tasted in the remotest past. Time sealed her away, yet she is dwelling still, like one who sleeps in timelessness at the bottom of the timeless sea."